This podcast is brought to you by Audible.com, the internet's leading provider of audiobooks with more than 75,000 downloadable titles across all types of literature, including fiction, nonfiction, and periodicals. For a free audiobook of your choice, go to audiblepodcast.com/bookreview.
Welcome to Inside the New York Times Book Review. I'm Sam Tannenhaus. This week, a conversation with Alexandra Jacobs about the unusual new memoir by novelist James Ellroy.
The woman he is pursuing most vigorously is dead. She is his mother. She was murdered. The killer has still not been found.
Julie Bosman has notes from the field. Kiama Glover discusses a most unusual co-written novel by two famous African-American authors.
I knew there were two authors, and I struggled as I was reading the novel to sort of parse out who might be who, and I couldn't do it.
And Jennifer Schussler has bestseller news.
This New York Times podcast is brought to you by Ford and voice-activated Sync, the in-car connectivity and entertainment system that features music search with the sound of your voice. Simply say the name of a song, band, artist, or genre of music available on your MP3 player to browse and play the music you want to hear. Sync is a system that's subscription-free, and it's available exclusively on Ford, Lincoln, and Mercury vehicles. For more details, visit SyncMyRidePodcast.com.
The crime writer James Ellroy, best known for the novel L.A. Confidential, has also had a most unusual life himself that he's described in a number of memoirs. He has a new book. It's called The Hilliker Curse, My Pursuit of Women. It's reviewed for us by the great Alexandra Jacobs, who I'm now proud to say is a colleague at the New York Times. She is an editor at the Thursday and Sunday Style sections. And she's here to talk about the book. Welcome, Alexandra.
Thank you for having me.
So, James Ellroy, The Pursuit of Women. Which women is he pursuing?
He is pursuing all women. For James Ellroy, woman is sort of an abstract concept. The woman he is pursuing most vigorously is dead. She is his mother. She died when he was 10. She was murdered. The killer has still not been found. This has haunted him in his entire life.
And he wrote about this, right?
He wrote about this around a decade ago, a memoir called My Dark Places that came out of an assignment for GQ to try and track down the killer. That memoir was much more methodical than this one. It was a sort of slightly cold...
Kind of a clinical book.
Clinical book. That's the word I was seeking. Thank you. He followed a detective. He retraced steps. He did a lot of details down to, you know, the autopsy results. This book is more of an emotional autopsy, and it's a lot messier, but in many ways a lot more interesting.
Alexandra, he wrote this book, My Dark Places, which, as you say, is a clinical attempt to solve the murder of his own mother. And does this new book in some way extend that story? Is this about the aftermath or consequences of having grown up with this crime that haunted him?
This book is a far more emotional and messier one than the previous memoir, and it's sort of less formal. I think of it as sort of spillover from what he was doing before. It's very raw. You know, he's never visited psychiatrists, but it's much more of a sort of delving into his various neuroses or an attempt to confront his emotions.
And his relationships with many women.
And his relationships with many women. And it becomes a bit numbing at times. It's a fascinating book, but the sort of, it can be hard to, you know, you might want to keep a scratch pad handy to graph all his different relationships, because at a certain point, the sheer numbers become sort of overwhelming.
And is he himself preoccupied or obsessed with the numbers? Is he keeping score?
No, he's not, which is, you know, I mean, in a way, and I think, you know, most men keep a list, right? maybe most people have a mental list of all their lovers. You know, in this book, he devotes, some women get a chapter, some get a page, some get a fleeting anecdote. You know, he doesn't remember all the names, but there's a kind of, it's a somewhat horrifying but very engrossing trajectory that he takes.
Where was he meeting these women?
Early in his mother was murdered when he was 10, And I think a lot of what this book is dealing with the fact that at the time, you know, you're 10 years old, your mother's killed. I mean, how do you, there's no way to process such a thing happening. And he had very complicated feelings about her already. He also reveals in the book, I don't think he's revealed this before, that he was molested by a babysitter. Poor little James Ellroy, his dad's like a no good nick. Early on, he just has these incredible obsessive crushes, and he stalks and he peeps. And it's really interesting because, you know, he's committing crimes just like the his protagonists in other novels. He's developing crushes on women, on high school women that he nurses for years.
So he's pursuing these women, and he describes his encounters with them, his relationships, or how they haunt
him. A lot of it is in his head. He has real problems with developing actual normal, societally acceptable relationships, because a lot of what he's doing is mythologizing, obsessing. There's also a lot of love him and leave him. And they're the women he idolizes, and then they're the ones he discards callously. And then toward the end of the book, he discusses the central women, the girlfriends who have actually caused him to progress psychologically and be able to work through. He really uses these women as, you know, it's like instead of therapy. I mean, he's really a self-therapizer.
And do we know, is he attractive to women?
I think, you know, as with many men, his success is a tremendous aphrodisiac. I mean, a lot of the women he's meeting, they come to his readings. He's a celebrity. So as he gets a lot, what we learn is that a lot of the motivation for him becoming a writer is to earn, as I'm sure motivates many writers, is to earn the adoration of the opposite sex.
Fame, fortune, and beautiful women, right? That's what Freud said. So does most of this happen in Los Angeles? Is this an L.A. story?
It's an L.A. story. It's interesting that, you know, his child is in L.A. He's somewhat peripatetic. I found very interesting the portion when he comes to New York and he's sort of making his bones as a writer, and he's a caddy at a golf club, and, you know, he sort of penetrates the publishing scene. He always is an outsider. I mean, that is his self-conception. You know, L.A. is his home, but he still, again, there's the breaking and entering. There's this sense of always being on the periphery and never having a home. It inspires an incredible amount of sympathy for someone whose deeds would otherwise, I think, be kind of repellent.
Thank you, Alexandra.
Thank you so much for having me.
That's Alexandra Jacobs, who reviews The Hilliker Curse, My Pursuit of Women by James Ellroy in this week's book review.
This podcast is brought to you by Audible.com, the internet's leading provider of audiobooks, with more than 75,000 downloadable titles across all types of literature, and featuring audio versions of many New York Times bestsellers. For listeners of this podcast, Audible is offering a free audiobook to give you a chance to try out their service. One audiobook to consider is The Red Queen by Philippa Gregory. Continuing to regale readers with stories of the fabled Tudor family, Gregory writes of Henry VIII's conspiring grandmother in a way that Publishers Weekly calls, quote, confident, colorful, convincing, and full of conflict. That's The Red Queen by Philippa Gregory, available from Audible. For a free audiobook of your choice, go to audiblepodcast.com/bookreview. That's audiblepodcast.com/bookreview.
Julie Bosman's here with Notes from the Field. Hi, Julie.
Hey, Sam.
So yet another Bob Woodward tell-all, behind the scenes, backstab, you name it. What's this one?
This is one of the biggest books of the fall season. Bob Woodward has a new book that comes out next Monday. It's called Obama's Wars. And it's the story of President Obama and his attempt to deal with the war in Afghanistan. As usually happens with Bob Woodward books, the book was obtained before the pub date, despite the attempt by Simon & Schuster, the publisher, to keep it under wraps until next Monday.
In fact, Mishiko Kakutani has already reviewed it in The Times. One of our White House correspondents, Peter Baker, has written about the contents of the book. The Washington Post has done it also. Somehow it already feels old, even though so few have seen the book.
Yes, I mean, it's this age-old publishing tradition of trying to control every bit of your publicity plan. And in this case, their plan was the same as it usually is with a Bob Woodward book. Well, instead of 60 Minutes, this time he was going to go on Good Morning America and have an interview with Diane Sawyer. But that was all going to happen next week. The Washington Post is going to run going to excerpt it. And then, of course, the book would go into bookstores. But now this all happens early. The Washington Post ran a news story after the Times did. And now readers just have to wait a few more days before they can get a copy of the book.
And just to clarify, the Washington Post news story is not written by Woodward himself. It's somebody else reporting on the contents of his book. Is that right?
Yes, which apparently they had queued up on a flash drive somewhere, ready to go in case the embargo was broken. So when it was on Tuesday night, the reporter who wrote the story scrambled to pull the story onto his computer and get it on the website, which they did at around 11:30, a couple hours after the story broke in the Times. And Mr. Woodward, of course, was reportedly not very happy that the embargo was broken, but he probably will have the consolation that he'll have his 16th bestseller next week.
Well, yes, this man has more bestsellers than Jay Leno has automobiles. It's hard to feel too sorry for him. But let me ask you a broader question about these embargoed books. Another example, maybe not quite as publicized, is former President Jimmy Carter, who was a memoir. His diaries are now out. He was on 60 Minutes. The book will zoom its way up the New York Times bestseller list, our bestseller list. But we at the Book Review just got the book today. After all this publicity, it almost doesn't make sense for us to review it. We may not review it. At what point does this process of embargoing books, withholding them from publication, actually do a disservice to readers?
Well, it seems to me that publishers want to have it both ways. They want to build up all of their pre-orders on Amazon. They want to build up the buzz as early as they can for all of their books that they think are going to be really big. But they also are torn about it because they don't want too much publicity before the book is available for purchase. So I think that their attitudes about this are kind of shifting. You know, they're thinking, well, maybe we should just take the publicity where we can get it early, build up the buzz. But they still think, okay, well, we're not going to send out copies to reviewers because we want to do as much as we can to control it. So I think that, you know, they're not really sure where they stand on this anymore. But there is a lot of evidence that booksellers will sometimes look at what the pre-orders are doing on Amazon and then base their ordering decisions on that. So that's something that I think is changing.
And Julie, this is also fundamentally a difference between fiction and nonfiction. If we look at, yet again, Freedom, Jonathan Franzen's much anticipated bestseller and acclaimed novel that there was a great deal of interest in, that could be sent out months ahead to reviewers or people who are interested in or cover publishing like you and me, and we could read it without the publishers fearing that news will leak because it's a novel. And the concern here, if I understand, is that there may actually be nuggets of news in a book by Bob Woodward that itself becomes important or discussed independent of the significance and quality of the published book. Is that right?
Right. So the New York Times, among other publications, see a Bob Woodward book as a news event, or at least a potential news event. So the Times, in this case, was not held to any agreement about keeping an embargo. So we wanted to get a copy of that book, and we worked to do it. Sometimes, as you know, a publisher will give a news organization a copy of a book, and they make an agreement that they won't write about it until a certain date. But this week, the Times and other papers were held to no such agreement.
Julie, but Bob Woodward's book is not the last embargoed book we're going to hear about, is it?
No, there happens to be another big one right around the corner that I'm sure that the Times will consider very newsworthy, and that is former President George W. Bush's memoirs, which comes out about a week after the midterm elections. And I know there's a great deal of interest in that book, and it will probably be considered very newsworthy.
Thanks a lot, Julie.
Thanks, Sam.
This New York Times podcast is brought to you by Ford and voice-activated Sync, the in-car connectivity and entertainment system that features music search with the sound of your voice. When you have Sync, you can simply say the name of a song, band, artist, or genre of music available on your MP3 player to browse and play the music you want to hear. You can also use the controls included in your vehicle's sound system to control most MP3 players. Sync is a system that's subscription-free, and it's available exclusively on Ford, Lincoln, and Mercury vehicles. For more details, visit SyncMyRidePodcast.com.
One of the most celebrated African-American authors of our time is the playwright Entozaki Shange, best known for a very celebrated play, soon to become a movie, called For Colored Girls Who Have Considered Suicide When the Rainbow Is Enough. She's also now a novelist, the author of a most unusual book, actually the co-author with Ifa Baeza of Some Sing, Some Cry. It's reviewed for us this week by Kiama Glover, who's here to talk about it. Welcome, Kiama.
Thank you.
First of all, Kiama, this is a long, ambitious novel, an unusual collaboration because of the relationship between the two authors.
Indeed, the two of them are sisters. So what we have in this 500-plus page book is the voice of at least two women, the two women who are authoring the book, obviously, and then the multitude of women that they feature as their sort of, and the different voices in the book.
Now, Kiama, people will be, I think many of our listeners will remember Entozaki Shange. Tell us a little bit about Ifa Baeza.
You know, I wish I could. I don't know very much about her, except that she, as well, is a very celebrated playwright. She's won a number of awards herself. The relationship with Ntozake Shange is something that I don't think is particularly well known, and this, I would imagine, will bring a great deal more attention to her.
It's a long novel, as you've said. It's also multi-generational. What's the story they're telling here?
The story begins on a slave plantation just after emancipation and ends in the 21st century, basically. So it traces the lives of multiple generations of African-American women from Charleston to Europe to South Africa and back and forth across the Atlantic.
Now, it's called Some Sing, Some Cry. Is there a musical component or theme in this novel?
Yeah, you know, the musical element, I'd say, of the novel is the thing that keeps it from being entirely pessimistic in some ways. I mean, this is the story of women who are just sort of gotten down and beaten down and are struggling with life all along the way. And in each instance, there's a connection to music, either traditional music or modern music or Motown or folk or what have you, that enables them to sort of survive and thrive.
You're a literary critic, a professor of literature. When you're reading this novel, can you tell one voice from the other? Are there Shange chapters and Baeza chapters, or does it sound like a single uniform voice?
Neither one nor the other. I knew there were two authors, and I struggled as I was reading the novel to sort of parse out who might be who, and I couldn't do it. And certainly there were moments in the book where there was abruptness or a change of tone, and I wanted, of course, to say, someone else picked up here where the other person left off. And it's obviously quite difficult to tell that. But what I can say is you do get the sense that there's more than one contribution from an author in the book. And that is really doubled or paralleled by the multiple, as I said earlier, the multiple voices of the characters in the book. So,
and in a sense, then, it's a microcosm of a large chunk of African-American, particularly female African-American history. How authentic is it? How true to the historical record is it? Or is it purely an act of imagination?
Oh, it's certainly not a pure act of imagination. I would say it's not only a chunk of African-American women's history, it's a chunk of American history. Mm. And that's one of the most impressive aspects of the book, is that it really lets you know from the get-go to what extent the most marginalized of members of the American community are integral to the broader American history. So we have, you know, the civil rights movement, we have emancipation, we have the birth of Motown, we have kind of seminal moments in American history, what should be known as American history, told through the lens of these women characters. So, yeah, they really bridge the gap between maybe traditional history and more marginalized history.
And what role do men play in this narrative? Be honest.
You know, men black and white do not fare very well under the pen of Shange and Baeza. These are women whose biggest obstacles in most instances are the men that they love, to be frank, or the men who love or want to love them. So there is absolutely a spirit of combativeness that's very much gender-aligned, which is also interesting because the solidarity that's formed among women sort of transcends race. I mean, all of the women in the novel, you'll see, are mixed-race women. So they kind of play with even the idea of the distinction of racial categories. What it's about is being a woman in America, I'd say, almost more than anything else.
And it's interesting because Shange, some of our listeners will remember, emerged as a leading voice in a period, the 1970s, when a number of very prominent and quite brilliant female African-American authors had a kind of double identity as feminists.
Absolutely.
Alice Walker is one, Toni Morrison another. Is that, without pigeonholing, is that the tradition these two authors belong to in some way, or are they doing something entirely different?
You know, that's a great point. They are absolutely part of a legacy of Afrofeminism, or some have called it womanism. I think that's Alice Walker's term, actually. But this idea that there is a phenomenon of double marginalization of black women, obviously race and gender, playing into their social realities and their ability to be mothers and things of that nature. And so this book is entirely in that tradition.
And so when we follow the story, is it generational? It's mother to daughter to daughter to daughter. And are these relationships closely established and linked? Is that where the dramatic narrative begins?
It's an interweaving. It absolutely traces generationally and chronologically from mother to daughter. But there's kind of a cumulative effect as well. Daughters then turn to grandmothers. Grandmothers then rely on aunts. It's more of a network or a web of women relations than it is a direct filiation, though that is certainly privileged as the narrative thread in the book.
Now, these are two, as you said, much lauded authors known best as playwrights. Mm-hmm. Is there a theatrical or dramatic component to this novel in addition to the narrative one? Is there dialogue or the scenes, those of playwrights?
You know, they clearly made a strong effort to make this a narrative, to step away, I think, from their identity as playwrights. You see it seep through the cracks in, as I mentioned a couple of times, the multiplicity of voices. This is a very polyphonic novel. Mm. And that in and of itself suggests a refusal to sort of focus on one omniscient being as being at the heart of the whole narrative. But nevertheless, you know, it's incredibly detailed in its description. There's plenty of third-person voice in addition to the dialogue. So at no point are we thinking, you know, this is just a kind of theatricalization of an epic story. It is meant to be an epic. It's meant to be a novel.
And you say something of a page-turner as well for all its complexity.
Indeed. In ways that are both good and bad, there's a certain sensationalistic quality to this book also. There are pure moments of, well, what is going to happen to this woman? Just given all the odds that these two authors have thrown at her, how is she going to get out of this mess? And that indeed keeps you going from chapter to chapter and sort of rooting for them to survive the situations in which they find themselves, the situations that are often just exceptionally awful.
Thanks a lot, Kiama. That's Kiama Glover, who this week reviews Some Sing, Some Cry by Enchezaki Shange and Ifa Baeza. Jennifer Schuessler is here with Bestseller News. Hi, Jenny.
Hi, Sam.
What is new on the list this week?
Well, we do have a new number one title on the nonfiction list. It's The Grand Design. This is Stephen Hawking's math-heavy analysis of Barack Obama's efforts to suck American democracy into a black hole, blow up the universe, and conceal the fact that he wasn't born in America but on the planet Mars.
Hey, wait a minute.
Oh, I'm confused. Sorry. That's the plot of David Limbaugh's book, Crimes Against Liberty, which drops to number two this week. Sorry, I'm confused. But seriously,
partisan, kind of raucous partisan books like Limbaugh's are, you know, still strong sellers in our sort of Tea Party moment. But the serious historians are also in their back-to-school mode. There are a bunch of quite serious histories on the list this week. Isabel Wilkerson's book, The Warmth of Other Suns, her great book about the Great Migration. She was on our podcast a couple weeks ago. She lands at number 5, very well-reviewed book. She's gotten a lot of attention. And Sean Wilentz, the Princeton historian, lands at number 9 with his exhaustive study, Bob Dylan in America. Also, S.C. Gwynne's book, Empire of the Summer Moon, this is his history of the last chief of the Comanches, is still at number 8. That's been kind of a sleeper hit. It's been on the list for about 3 months now.
That's great. What about fiction?
Jonathan Franzen, still at number 1 with Freedom.
Well, what a guy!
Yep, second week for him. See how long he can hold on. Otherwise, this is kind of a great week for follow-ups. Terry McMillan lands at number 4 with Getting to Happy. This is a sequel to her smash hit from 15 years ago, Waiting to Exhale, longer than 15 years ago. That book, I'm sure you've read it, Sam. It spent about almost a year on the list.
And was a big film, too.
Yeah, so I think she's probably got a film deal going on that. So this looks at what's happened to the same 4 women in Phoenix that were in the first book. Sarah Gruen lands on the list with Ape House. This is her follow-up to her smash hit, Water for Elephants. She's sort of going through the species here. First, she wrote about communicating with elephants. Here, she's writing about communicating with apes, specifically a troop of sign language using bonobos. And William Gibson lands at number 9 with Zero History. This is sort of a follow-up to his novel Spook Country. Some of the same characters come back, and they are working in a viral marketing and cool hunting agency.
Well, speaking of sequels, what about the Preppy Handbook?
You know, when I came in this morning and I saw you rocking the pink and green, I knew you were going to ask me about the Preppy Handbook, Sam. So True Prep, this is the sequel to the big early 80s sensation, the Preppy Handbook. It's at number 2, I believe. Yes, number 2 on the hardcover how-to and advice list. And I personally was very satisfied to see it doing better than Gunn's Golden Rules, the book by the Project Runway style meister Tim Gunn. Maybe that tells you something about my style. I don't know. Do you want to wear mother's old gardening pants handed down for generations, or do you want to be asked to make a garden party dress out of actual gardening supplies, which the Project Runway contestants had to do once? I don't know. Your decision. So one interesting thing about this, about True Prep, is the way that, you know, the prepster has sort of changed and kind of modernized, been come into the 21st century. There's an interesting sidebar about preppies who have converted to Islam. There's stuff about, you know, whether it's acceptable to go to Disneyland. Now it's okay as long as you only go once, or at least once for each set of kids with each wife. But still, the thing no preppy would ever do is go on reality TV, unless maybe it's the show Hoarders.
Thanks a lot, Jenny.
Thanks, Sam.
Thanks for listening. And remember, there's more at nytimes.com/books. You can tell us what you think of this show or any New York Times podcast by emailing podcasts@nytimes.com. I'm Sam Tannenhaus.